We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall never surrender.
Hi there. My name is Joe Campo. I'm a professor of history, and this is the Harvest of Mars podcast, where we will explore the history of warfare. It's been a while since my last upload. The beginning of a semester is always a hectic time for me. For this episode, we'll compare the combat between World War I and World War II, specifically looking at the power of the attack and contemplate why it was that attacks in the First World War seemed so futile in contrast to the Second. Every student who has taken a class on European history has heard the same explanation why the fighting was so different in the two world wars. The First World War, fought between 1914 to 1918, was characterized by trenches, stalemate, and near-suicidal attacks because the military technology at the time, in particular machine guns, barbed wire, and quick-firing artillery, favored the defensive. Tanks and planes were in their infancy, and these machines were too primitive to be decisive weapon systems. But they did show promise. Theorists such as J.F.C. Fuller and Giulio Duhet during the 1920s argued that the tank and plane were revolutionary technologies that would dictate the course of future warfare. When the German Blitzkrieg of the Second World War, spearheaded by modern tanks and aircraft, produced rapid and decisive victories, such as the shocking fall of France in just 6 weeks, the standard historical explanation was that the mechanization of warfare, combined with the skill of German military leadership, had returned the advantage to the offensive. So the classroom lecture goes. It's not wrong. However, putting this tried but not quite tested tale under closer scrutiny reveals it's not quite right, or, at the least, is oversimplified. There are two ways to look at this. First, was it actually the weapons at the time, artillery, machine guns, and trenches, that brought about the stalemate in World War I? Maneuver and attack were definitely possible in the First World War. The initial Schlieffen Offensive in 1914 came just within 30 miles of Paris. The Russian Brusilov Offensive in 1916 shattered the Austro-Hungarian army. The Caporetto and German Spring Offensives in 1918 relied more on tactical rather than technological adaptations. These offensives showed that relying on static defenses was untenable, as determined attackers could break into the enemy's lines. The problem attackers had was breaking out. The defender generally had an intact transport network and could rail in reinforcements and supplies much faster than the attackers who had to walk and rely on horse-drawn supply lines over a devastated battlefield. And there would always be reinforcements for the defender on the Western Front because the Industrial Revolution had enabled belligerents to mobilize millions of men and thousands of miles of railway track to get them where they needed to be. Also crucial for any stalemate explanation was that the war potential of the Central Powers and the Entente were roughly the same. Historian Paul Kennedy, in his influential book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, persuasively argued that large coalition wars were won and lost by each side's economic strength and its ability to mobilize its resources. Probably the two best indicators of an advanced industrial economy in the early 20th century are steel production and energy consumption. In 1913, the Central Powers between them produced 20.2 million tons of steel, compared to the Entente's 16.7 million tons. For energy consumption, here are the figures in metric million tons of coal. Central Powers, 236. Entente, 312. Between the two, they're awfully close. Even with the advanced tanks and aircraft in the Second World War, when their relative strengths were comparable, the result was often ebb and flow or just flat-out stalemate. For instance, in the Western Desert Campaign, the British Commonwealth and Axis went back and forth fighting over the same ground for 1.5 years before decisive Allied superiority brought that campaign to a successful conclusion in just one-third that time. Another example, the Americans and Japanese fought for 6 months on Guadalcanal before U.S. industrial power tipped the scales and put Japan on the permanent strategic defensive. Both sides in any war are going to have their share of brilliance and blunders, of fortunes and mishaps. At the end of the day, it is the production, the economic mobilization, the total war potential that wins and loses great coalition wars. Before the United States joined the Entente, the two sides were relatively even, and this manifested in military stalemate. Another reason I would favor an economic explanation to stalemate is because what is usually thought of as offense and defense is misleading. In a battle, just who is attacking and defending is often blurred to the point where it isn't easy to say. It is true there is a side whose planners draw lines on a map, initiate the action, go over the top, move forward, and seek to break through the enemy line. That is, fulfilling all the criteria that are traditionally associated with the offensive. However, as much as heroic movies like to emphasize troops stoically standing firm and holding a line, such a tactic is an invitation to getting surrounded and wiped out. A defender must constantly shift their forces, withdrawing them to avoid encirclements here, transferring them to threatened sectors there, and critically, counterattacking enemy penetrations anywhere they occur. Let me repeat that last part again. Defenders have to try to take the initiative, leave the safety of their trenches, go over the top, and attack the enemy, who more than likely will be seeking refuge behind hastily constructed, you guessed it, defenses. Every student of European history has learned about the 1916 Battle of the Somme in a lecture, a book, or a documentary. This was the first great attack by the British Expeditionary Force, involving millions of men and over 1,000 artillery pieces. The students learned that the German defenders survived the 1.5 million shells the British guns fired at them, and then proceeded to mow down the British infantry, inflicting a mind-boggling 57,470 casualties on the first day alone, the single most deadly day in British military history. Here the lecture often ends, and students are left with the impression that the generals were donkeys for ordering such pointless attacks. How many of those same students know that on the very same first day, the French, who are often left out of the Somme story, succeeded in taking their objectives for the loss of just 1,600 casualties? Or that the battle lasted 4.5 months, during which the Germans felt compelled to launch constant counterattacks and suffer enormous losses in order to stave off Allied penetration and retake crucial terrain. According to historian J.P. Harris, from July 15th to September 14th, the British launched 90 attacks, to the Germans 70 counterattacks. Just who was attacking whom? At the end of the Somme battle, the Allies had suffered 630,000 total casualties, that is, killed, wounded, missing, or captured. We don't know how many casualties the Germans suffered. The so-called best sources put this figure at 500,000, although some sources go as high as 650,000. There does seem to be more agreement regarding the number of soldiers killed. British and French combined 158,000, to the Germans' 160,000 KIA. Yes, you heard that right. The Battle of the Somme, commonly portrayed as the height of offensive folly by the donkey British general Douglas Haig, actually wound up killing more German defenders than he himself had suffered. As it turns out, sitting in your trench on the defensive won't save you from dying. In the popular imagination, the battlefields of World War I seem to be portrayed as exceptionally lethal, which feeds the whole defensive stalemate narrative. And the hundreds of thousands who fell at Verdun, the Somme, and Passchendaele certainly seem to drive that point home. But those casualties were so high because the Industrial Revolution had enabled so many human bodies to be in those battles that literally lasted for months, not because the World War battlefield was unusually lethal. Battlefields during any era were deadly. More soldiers died in one day at Borodino in 1812 than on that first day of the Somme. Let's make a direct comparison between the battlefields of World War I and World War II. If there is any battle that epitomizes the whole lions led by donkeys caricature, it's Passchendaele. As British historian John Terrain remarked in a speech, Passchendaele is still, I think, the most emotive word in our whole military vocabulary. Passchendaele was, for a long time, and for some people remains, a synonym for a particular kind of horror, as though such a dreadful thing had never happened before or since. That's about the right of it. For 102 days, British Commonwealth troops went over the top and, according to modern estimates, suffered some 260,000 casualties just to advance the mere 5 miles. Or, put another way, in their attack, every day the British lost 2,549 men. By way of comparison, while defending every day during the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, 2,272 Americans became casualties in a battle they won. That's pretty close. Or better yet, let's compare the British experience at Passchendaele to the quintessential Blitzkrieg operation, the German conquest in France in 1940. In those 43 days, the Germans suffered about 175,000 casualties. That's over 4,000 per day, more than 50% higher than the British rate at Passchendaele. Nobody ever accused German panzer generals like Manstein, Guderian, or Rommel as being donkeys. Even if we don't count prisoners, the Allies suffered an astonishing 8,761 casualties every day during the 1940 French campaign. That's more than 3 times the rate of Passchendaele. So what's the point here? The attacker, as we traditionally understand the term, during the First World War did not die or suffer casualties at rates unlike the defenders or the combat fought in the Second World War. It also needs to be remembered that there was maneuver on the Eastern Front. Brusilov's offensive, just using 1914 tech of artillery, machine guns, cavalry, and the bayonet, shattered the Central Powers defenders and bagged hundreds of thousands of prisoners, anticipating the monumental blitzkrieg encirclements that the Germans would inflict on the Soviet Union during the summer of 1941. Putting all this together, I would say that the stalemate that arose on the Western Front was first and foremost a result of the two sides being evenly matched, rather than specific technologies or battlefield lethality. The memory of Passchendaele is not wrong, as it was horrific, but it's not quite right in portraying it as a slaughterhouse relative to history's other battlefields. One look at the contemporary German records reveals the frustrations and the desperation of their generals to come up with some sort of answer to the pressure of the British attackers. Colonel Albrecht von Thayer remarked mid-battle, "I do not know anymore what to do in the face of the British." The German defenders were getting overwhelmed by the power of the attack. what stabilized the German line at Passchendaele was not the sophistication of German defensive tactics. It was the tyranny of distance. The British had to walk or horse supplies and reinforcements to their forward troops, whereas the Germans could more quickly rail in reinforcements, which were then thrown in desperate and costly counterattacks just to stem the tide. Even with World War I tech, attackers consistently broke the front lines of the most elaborate of defenders. If attackers ever figured out a way to move faster than a walking pace, static defense was untenable. Nothing I am saying here wasn't known to military experts and theorists. B.H. Littlehart, Hans von Siegt, Charles de Gaulle, Mikhail Tukhachevsky, Heinz Guderian, and most notably J.F.C. Fuller all argued this forcibly during the interwar period. Although their theories are often boiled down to tanks or armored warfare, what they identified as essential for offensive operations was track transports that could bring infantry, essential for holding ground during any historical era, quickly into the enemy's rear. Speed and off-road mobility were the essential factors. The infantry of World War I was bound to rails, asphalt roads, or walking. If the British could have got their reserves at Passchendaele to the points where they had broken the German lines, Colonel Thayer would have done more than complaining that he did not know what to do. He would have been offering his surrender. These theorists were not heeded because their arguments weren't obvious. They were based off impersonal calculations on a war everybody wanted to forget. They were mavericks who were talking about military offensives at a time when Europe bereaved over the millions of dead from the Great War. The 1920s was an era when the imagery of gas, trenches, and nightmares of Passchendaele pervaded public narratives. When the perception that the military cast were donkeys. When the prevailing belief, still in just about every modern European history textbook, was that the military defensive was obviously stronger. The memories of World War I trumped their cold historical understanding. This is important to comprehend because those misleading memories dictated policy. Nowhere was this more evident than in France. Its generals thought defensive, its doctrine was defensive, and it invested a massive amount of monies, building the infamous Maginot Line, a much-touted defensive bastion on the German border, which was deemed impenetrable. Unemotional, detached analyses of World War I had demonstrated this was a bankrupt strategy. Yet that's the road the French went down. Older histories claim that Germany's road was different, that its generals had taken these theorists to heart and birthed what had become known as the Blitzkrieg. It's a self-serving story that is more myth than reality. To begin with, as historian Karl Heinz Freiser has persuasively noted, the Germans themselves did not have a coherent theory of modern war, emphasizing machines like aircraft and tanks. Rather, Blitzkrieg came about almost accidentally, by improvisational acts by generals who were trained in a tradition that emphasized maneuver and attack. Research by other scholars do make a persuasive argument that the Germans themselves did not recognize that these new technologies were obvious offensive game changers. Indeed, during the French campaign in 1940, the Allies had more tanks and more mobile elements in their army. If the Germans were alone in understanding the power of these new weapon systems, then surely they would have had more, right? What was decisive was not the appearance of these new military technologies or even their deployment. Instead, it was that the Germans were more flexible in their use and had deep-rooted military traditions that were better able to exploit new possibilities. Their early war dramatic victories were against opponents in France who failed to recognize warfare had changed, and in the Soviet Union, against a military that had decapitated its brain trust because of political paranoia. In sum, Germany's Blitzkrieg was less the culmination of military technologies and more the sum of favorable circumstances. Once the Allies had overcome the learning curve and fielded better commanders, better weapons, and better trained soldiers, that was the end of these dramatic and decisive offensives. Scrutinizing those early German victories reveal the limitations of military offensives in modern war. The 1940 conquest of France was a shock to contemporaries, and it is no accident that two of the most influential studies of that campaign are called Strange Defeat and Strange Victory. Those titles hint that the German victory came about by an unusual historical context, and indeed, that is what the authors argue. Either French society was fractured and failed to adapt to a modern changing world, or the Germans were lucky that Allied military strategy was so bad. Something else that does not get enough attention are the short geographical distances involved. Heinz Guderian's panzers only had to go 150 miles to reach the English Channel and thus cut off the Allied armies once they broke through at Sedan. That's about the same distance from Philadelphia to Washington, a drive that takes me about 3 hours. In the event, even going that short distance was incredibly risky, as it presented an exposed flank to a theoretical Allied reserve. Indeed, the German High Command was clearly nervous as it ordered its panzers to halt and consolidate while the British were evacuating at Dunkirk. Although some historians argue this whole order was a grave mistake, the fact of the matter is those panzer divisions had already spent their strength getting that far and could not break through the stout French rearguard defense. Attacking armies still faced the same problem as in World War I. There was only a short distance they could exploit any breakthrough before outrunning their supply lines. Faster tanks and tracked vehicle transport had extended that distance, but these modern military machines and their accompanying troops still required fuel, ammunition, food, and other supplies that had to come via rail or road. In World War I, the attacking Germans got within 30 miles of Paris before being stopped at the Battle of the Marne. The English Channel is about the same distance away as Paris. Guderian's panzers got there and trapped the Allied armies, but that was the end of their tether, hence the much-celebrated miracle of Dunkirk. Unfortunately for the French, those extra 30 miles were decisive. While the evacuation was successful, those were the best Allied forces, and they had to leave behind all of their heavy equipment. So there wasn't much left to defend the French heartland. When the Germans resumed their offensive, once they broke through, distance was no longer a factor because there was no French reserves in the field. It was a rout. Erwin Rommel, one of the German panzer commanders, wrote to his wife that this phase of the campaign was a lightning tour de France because he was driving his tanks as fast as they could go from town to town, facing no opposition. The other touted example of the German Blitzkrieg was its invasion of the Soviet Union, which featured sweeping advances of mechanized armies and enormous encirclements, resulting in the destruction of literally hundreds of thousands of Red Army troops in a given battle. While these were impressive feats that have inspired armchair generals to try and recreate them via war games on their kitchen table or computer, it must be emphasized that the Germans lost at the end of the campaign when the Soviets counterattacked at the gates of Moscow. Even the vaunted Blitzkrieg was not able to overcome the tyranny of distance. It was once widely believed that the German failure was primarily due to strategic mistakes. The most common argument was that Hitler had interfered with his general's advice to take Moscow by diverting his powerful panzer army south to take Kyiv. While this resulted in a great victory, destroying the Soviet southwestern front and perhaps as much as a staggering 700,000 men, the Germans lost the one thing they could not afford: time. The attack on Moscow was not launched until October, which meant they had to contend with generals Mudd and Winter and, so the argument goes, missed their chance. Historians are now rightly skeptical of this line of reasoning. The problem that faced the Germans was that the distances in the Soviet Union were too far for a contested advance, even from an army with modern tanks, a skilled air force, and a highly trained and disciplined troops, which the Germans had amply demonstrated they possessed. The Germans themselves recognized this, a fact that needs emphasis. The Barbarossa plan was predicated on routing the Soviet army near the border. It was never planned to actually have to fight its way to Moscow. Rather than honestly confront the problems associated with the tyranny of distance, Germany strategists casually assumed it would be irrelevant because the Soviets would rout. Such presumption made the whole operation more wishful thinking than an actual military strategy. Germany was trying to repeat history. Its defeat of the Russian Empire in World War I came about because the Russian army ceased to be effective fighting forces when the Tsarist regime collapsed. In the 3 years of fighting from 1914 to 1917, the Germans had only advanced to eastern Poland. When the Bolsheviks seized power in their revolution, they did not have a functioning military. The Germans literally put their troops on Russian trains and advanced hundreds of miles within a week. As General Hoffman wrote in his diary about this railway war, "It is the most comical war I've ever known. We put a handful of infantrymen with machine guns and one gun on a train and rush them off to the next station. They take it, make prisoners of the Bolsheviks, pick up a few more troops, and so on. This proceeding has, at any rate, the charm of novelty." Exactly. It was a novelty, not a contested military advance. The same could be said for Rommel's lightning tour de France. Both of these surprising German victories had been achieved because of collapsing governments and routed armies that were no longer capable of fighting back. The Germans believed they had learned the lessons of history that they themselves had experienced twice. A fierce military blow would shatter the enemy's army, political collapse would ensue, and then their armies could mop up in an uncontested advance. An examination into Operation Barbarossa's planning, a very generous term given that the plan was just to send 3 million German troops into the depths of the Soviet Union, reveals the Germans were counting on a repeat of these uncontested railroad offensives after a rapid collapse of the Red Army. The quartermaster general warned his superiors that the German army would run out of fuel and outrun their supplies by August, long before they reached Moscow. He was met with a collective meh because Soviet military resistance would crumble before then. As Hitler himself was reported to have said about the Soviet Union, "You only need to kick the door and a whole rotten structure will come crashing down." Kicking the door, the Germans did. The Soviet military was caught completely by surprise and suffered incredible losses that are mind-boggling. At Minsk, they lost 350,000 troops. At Smolensk, 450,000. At the Bryansk-Vyazma pocket, another 600,000. But the Soviets did not collapse or rout. So as impressive as these offensives were, the historical reality was strategic failure, and they show the very real limitations that restricted what a World War II offensive could accomplish. The best historical study on the constraints and shortcomings to the German attack in the Soviet Union, even when it seemed to be winning, is David Stahel's study called Operation Barbarossa and Germany's Defeat in the East. Stahel presents clear evidence that while the German panzers could consistently break through Soviet defenses, Germany did not have the capability to sustain the advance of those panzers because it did not have enough trucks to supply them. Moreover, 85% of its divisions had to walk, and the Soviet dirt roads led to so many vehicle breakdowns that Germany wasn't even able to replace or maintain the limited number that they had. The German commanders themselves were apprehensive in their reports about their own weakening strength, even as it was pulling off these victories during the summer of 1941. As long as the Soviet Red Army stayed in the field and continued its resistance, the German advance would run out of steam and eventually overextend. Critics might point out it's one thing to make this claim with the benefit of hindsight, it's another to show that with evidence. For good reason. Current historiography of the Nazi-Soviet war leans a bit too far in the realm of inevitability, in my opinion. However, when it comes to what the German Blitzkrieg was capable of, we do have a pattern. In the first large encirclement at Minsk, the German panzers covered a little more than 200 miles in about a week. And then they had to wait for the leg infantry to catch up. At the second encirclement at Smolensk, it took 17 days to go about that same distance. And then they had to wait for the leg infantry to catch up. And also hold off constant, albeit unsuccessful, Red Army counterattacks. And wait for supplies, spare parts, and replacements. There are a lot of ands here because a sustained advance requires more than just moving tanks on a battlefield. It was not until August 24th that Guderian's panzers advanced on Kyiv, a full 3 weeks after the Germans considered the Battle of Smolensk over. Once again, the Germans advanced about 200 miles southward toward Kyiv and completed the encirclement on September 16th, 23 days later. It's clear that against an army capable of organized resistance, Germany's Blitzkrieg could be counted on to advance 200 miles before the need for reorganization, resupply, and reinforcements compelled that advance to stop. Even when enjoying incredible victories, Germany's panzer divisions were weakened after every such operation. Hence, the time in between those operations and to go those 200 miles lengthened. Modern tanks and modern aircraft did not solve the age-old problem of overextension. They just enabled a ridiculously expensive and resource-intensive small portion of an attacking army to advance 200 miles and hope the rest of the army, along with its vulnerable support system, could follow up before the enemy counterattacked and cut the spearhead off. So that's a lot to take in, and it would be useful to catch our breath here and boil this down. In World War I, although it is commonly stated that the defensive was stronger, attackers consistently proved they were able to break into the enemy's position and inflict as many casualties that they themselves had suffered. The difficulty was breaking out. Defenders with intact transit lines could bring in more reinforcements and throw them in desperate counterattacks faster than the attackers could walk or horse theirs. In World War II, attackers had half-tracked vehicles that allowed the infantry to break out. With this development, static defense was untenable. Defenders had to also be mobile. The problem now for the attackers is that their tracked vehicles had a limited operational range before they ran out of fuel and ammunition. Germany's Blitzkrieg campaign shows the range to be about 200 miles. After that, rest, recovery, and refit were necessary to get an attacking force back to full strength. Because the Germans were desperate to knock out the Soviet Union in a single campaign, they tried to rush the slow process of supply and reinforcement, and thus their armies weakened the further they advanced. That is why they lost the Battle of Moscow, not because it snowed. The Western Desert Campaign between the famous German Africa Corps and the British 8th Army perhaps best shows this pattern of attack and then subsequent overextension. For 1.5 years, both sides attacked, advanced hundreds of miles, then outran their supplies, and were counterattacked, then thrown back hundreds of miles. In December 1940, the British attacked and destroyed a much larger and immobile Italian army, capturing the province of Cyrenaica. In April the next year, Axis forces under General Erwin Rommel chased them all the way back to the Egyptian border. The following November, the Allies recaptured all of Cyrenaica and put Rommel right back where he started. Then, in dramatic fashion in May 1942, the reinforced Africa Corps counterattacked and advanced deep into Egypt until it completely overextended itself and was stopped at the now famous railway town of El Alamein. Every 5 to 6 months, rinse, wash, and repeat. One side feels strong enough to attack, does so and breaks through, then rapidly advances and overextends, leaving itself vulnerable to an eventual counterattack by the other side, who was much closer to their base of supply. This pattern was broken only when the Allies were able to put decisive superiority of forces in North Africa at El Alamein and the subsequent torch landings in Morocco and Algeria during 1942. Once the Allies were preponderant in land, sea, air, and supply, the nearly 2 years of ebb and flow that characterized the North African campaign was wrapped up with complete Allied victory in just 6 months. On paper, the Allies were in a better position to liberate Europe than the Nazis were able to conquer it. They had significant superiority of forces, produced massive amounts of oil, possessed unquestioned air superiority, and their armies were far more motorized. Yet they too were restricted by the tyranny of distance. To be sure, the Allies executed some devastating offensives that were every bit as impressive as the early war blitzkrieg, such as Operations Bagration and Cobra. Bagration virtually destroyed an entire German army group as the Soviets advanced a little more than, wait for it, 200 miles. Then those Soviet armies sat for 6 months before taking the final attack, which eventually led to the capture of Berlin. U.S. General George S. Patton's breakout after Cobra was every bit the lightning tour de France as Rommel's, covering about 300 miles before literally running out of gas. After that dramatic advance, the Western Allies stalled for about 6 months before breaking through the Rhine and ending German resistance. Critics might point to missed opportunities, such as the Falaise Gap, or the questionable broad front strategy by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, but at the end of the day, the matter was decided by logistics. It was easier and less resource intensive for the Germans to rail reinforcements and supplies to their forces retreating towards their home base than it was for the Allies to disembark them to Channel ports and then truck them to forces moving away from their supply base. The Americans, because of their ridiculous productive capacity, were the only belligerent capable even trying to use trucks en masse. Yet the tyranny of distance caught up with their armies in September 1944, as they were contained by relatively weak German forces for 6 months. So all attacking World War II armies, regardless of how brilliant its leadership, followed the same pattern. Successfully break through the enemy's defenses, outrun its own supplies, be forced to stop, consolidate, wait, sometimes for months, until enough reinforcements and supplies arrive to go on the next offensive. The exception to this pattern was the strange German victory over France. But how strange was it? Defense was already a questionable proposition in World War I. If the Allies had paid more attention to the cold analyses of Passchendaele and less to the traumatic memories of it, then they would have neither built the Maginot Line nor suffered from the accompanying mentality that precluded offensive thinking. Willingly granting the Germans the initiative was an unacceptable blunder because the distances in Northwest Europe were too short to take such a gamble. The German panzers only had to go 130 miles to cut off and surround the best Allied armies, and that was well within their capability. I think the only way we'd ever know just how strange that campaign was is if the distances in Western Europe were a little longer. If the tyranny of distance had stalled the German advance and allowed the Allies to recover from their terrible strategy, then it is possible that the Germans would have run into the same problem British Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery did during his ambitious Market Garden operation, namely, trying to reach a bridge too far. When considering all of this, the generals of the First World War get a bad rap. Never mind that it was the politicians that had sent them to the war, and a clamorous public who demanded victory that are hardly ever thought of as donkeys. The generals of World War I were dedicated professionals who were damned if they do and damned if they don't. What would we have them do? Sitting in their trenches and defending got them killed in the hundreds of thousands. They adapted, tried new tactics, used new weapons, and by the war's later years, the power of the attack was devastating. Even the Germans, who are generally regarded to have had the most sophisticated defensive trench system, could only stop the British by counterattacking. British Field Marshal Douglas Haig is often viewed as the poster child of the uncaring donkey, a butcher who threw the lives of his men away. But thousands of his men came to honor him at his funeral when he died in 1928. Haig and his peers are remembered as donkeys because that provides us with an intellectually comforting conclusion that the millions who died in the First World War was due to the stupidity of an elite military caste, rather than an indictment of the folly of human beings who are so easily convinced to go to war and demand the blood of their enemies. World War I generals executed offensives that broke the enemy's defensive lines. What stopped them were forces beyond their control. Namely, the enemy could get their reinforcements faster and throw them in desperate counteroffensives. That's not just my conclusion. That is what the German High Command determined during the Battle of Passchendaele. As the German official history comments, the Army High Command came to the conclusion that there was no means by which the positions could be held against the overwhelming enemy superiority in infantry or artillery. Loss of ground in these heavy enemy attacks was unavoidable. World War I armies were devastating in their attack. What they lacked was the means to break out and exploit their penetrations because they were limited to a walking pace. It was by no means obvious that tracked vehicles tilted the balance to the offensive. Indeed, the French thought they did not, and the Germans were surprised at their own successes during the French campaign. But even then, there were limitations. Tanks and their accompanying troop-carrying half-tracks had off-road capability, but the trains and trucks needed to supply and reinforce them did not. Even the United States, which had the most lavishly equipped motorized army in the world, with ridiculously effective artillery support and air dominance, saw its most aggressive and brilliant general stall in his pursuit because of the iron rule of logistics. The Western Allies had at least a 2-to-1 ratio of combat effectiveness, and perhaps a 20-to-1 superiority in tanks. Yet they were locked in a static campaign for months after outrunning their supplies. Mechanized armies are indeed deadly in the attack, but they are weak at the end of their operational range, which is about 200 miles, and vulnerable to counterattack. Sustaining an attack was still a daunting challenge. The Germans were able to avoid this in 1940 because France collapsed. As the Soviet Union did not collapse the next year, the paper came due when the Germans overextended themselves at Moscow, and then again the following year at Stalingrad. The Allies overcame the tyranny of distance by manufacturing 4.5 tanks for every one built by the Germans, having a veritable monopoly on oil production, and a total commitment to the cause such that millions are willing to sacrifice their lives.